Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, a medical tax credit phase-out raises affordability fears ahead of NHI. Fly Safair crew threaten to strike as wage talks stall. South Africa's gambling problem now reaching crisis proportions. And EdTech Week focuses on tech readiness in under-resourced schools. It's Tuesday, the 4th of November. The Board of Healthcare Funders has written to National Treasury demanding urgent clarity on plans to phase out medical scheme tax credits to help fund the National Health Insurance. Now, government officials, as I understand it, have told Parliament that these credits could start being withdrawn from next year, beginning with higher income earners and ending by 2029 for everybody. But the NHI itself may take up to 15 years to fully roll out. That is prompting warnings that millions of middle and lower income South Africans could lose financial protection long before a workable alternative exists. So let's explore this in a little more detail. I'm talking now to Dr. Katlego Mothudi, who's Managing Director of the BHF. Katlego, welcome to you and thank you very much indeed. Maybe a good starting point for our conversation, and just very briefly, explain to us what a medical scheme tax credit actually is. What's its purpose?
The medical tax credits were introduced in, I think, around 2012 to replace what was deemed to be a regressive form of taxation on medical aid contributions. Previously, you would just claim back what you paid in, and that put people on higher options, or arguably with the higher earnings, at an advantage. Now, tax credits that were introduced, it was a flat rate for everyone, and you are able to get back a nominal amount for each member that you are paying for. I think it's pegged at, 364 rand for the first two members, and then 246, I think, for the subsequent ones. Now, that gives an advantage to those people who are on the lower brackets.
So what is your understanding then of why these credits are being removed before the NHI is fully operational? And what do you think the immediate impact is going to be?
It doesn't make immediate sense to us, Jeremy, and that's why we've written to Treasury to actually ask for clarification. The first point is that there are mixed messages in terms of the department in at Parliament saying that they have a plan to phase this out over the next 3 years. But in court papers submitted against one of the litigations, they said that there was no immediate plan to do that. So it is estimated that government is looking for, I think, about 34 billion rand that is back as credits, and they want to include that as part of the budget for NHI. Now, it doesn't make sense because there is nothing in place at the moment, and these plans for funding are not against other operational plans for the NHI, and that's why we wrote to actually ask for clarity. Now, the impact is that we actually did a report about a year ago. We estimate that anything between 400 and 700,000 people who are on medical aid will stop being able to afford medical aid premiums. which immediately then swings the pendulum back to state support for healthcare for these families. And this not only affects those people who earn lower salaries, even those people who are high earners may be forced to actually downgrade because the premiums will actually become more when you remove other people from the system.
Are you seeing this as a desperate bid by government to fund the NHI, which is on the back foot anyway?
It does appear so. And if you actually look at the parliamentary presentation, it is actually prefaced by saying that there's been many complaints about the absence of a plan to fund NHI. So it looks like there is a scramble to try and find a plan to do exactly that. And we don't think that it's a viable method. Yeah.
So what's your next move then, apart from asking for clarity?
Obviously, there are processes, I think, broadly to look at NHI. Our litigation is part of that process. You may be aware that one of the arguments that we have put forth in our court papers are that there is no credible funding plan. So the litigation remains a big part of what we are going to do to seek a way of making sure that whatever is going to be introduced actually makes sense. Part of that problem is that government wants to do away with medical aid schemes. And we think that removing the tax credits becomes a big part of that plan. So this will also be dealt with, I think, adequately through the litigation process.
Is there a short-term way of balancing then universal healthcare goals with financial protection, particularly as you've referenced working families?
I think there is a need to look at what the healthcare sector globally needs. There are challenges that we have in the private sector, and there are also challenges in the public sector. We do not think that the proposed plan to remove everything as per proposed plan will actually afford us that. And I think it just means going back to basics. We've been at pains to say that when you want to revamp the health system, you must look at the blueprint that others have actually started working on. And the WHO has spoken a lot about this. We have to look at our leadership and governance systems, make sure that the service delivery can actually happen with the right infrastructure, make sure that the supply chain management processes are actually put in place. And then on the private side, we've spoken at length about the health market inquiry and the recommendations that came out of it. All those things are actually being ignored. And those are tangible things that can actually be implemented now to have changes, I would say, maybe in the intermediate term.
What would your best advice then be to people who are currently members of medical aid schemes? What do they need to do? Just sit tight and wait?
I think there should be an understanding of what is currently happening. We know that schemes are expensive. The barrier to entry is mostly financial. Now, what can people do? First, an understanding of how schemes function. Part of the challenge with the claims experience is also as a result of inappropriate utilization of benefits. So get to understand how schemes work, and as far as possible, make sure that we are also responsible citizens and consumers in the system.
Thank you very much indeed. I've been in conversation with Dr. Katlego Mothudi, who is Managing Director of the Board of Healthcare Funders.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's gambling industry has quietly grown into a 75 billion rand force. That is roughly the size of the Western Cape's annual budget. New data from 80-20 shows that 42% of South Africans gamble monthly, more than those paying school fees or insurance, and online betting now dominates, fueled by smartphones, aggressive advertising, and economic stress. But behind the boom, I think, sits real rising social concern, hidden losses, households under pressure. So let's discuss what this means for the economy and for you and I and policymakers. And I'm in conversation now with Andrew Fulton. He's been on our program before, director at 80-20. Andrew, always good talking to you. 42% of adults, as I mentioned, gambling monthly. This is not just a lifestyle shift, isn't it? It's now a full-blown crisis, surely.
Yeah, no, thanks for having us on the show, Jeremy. It is a lot of people. And you know, as a strategy analytics and research company, we're tracking where money's going and where to find growth. And, you know, this and buy now, pay later and a few other recent developments in the economy are taking a lot of money out of people's pockets. And as you mentioned, this one is $75 billion. The other real interesting stat is $1.5 trillion is what's wagered in any given year, which in relative terms, I mean that's between half and a third of all expenditure in South Africa in a year. I mean it really is quite huge.
That $1.5 trillion seems like an enormous amount of money. Do you really buy that number?
Yeah, I mean this is released from the industry itself. So what one has to understand is that money is recycled. So you wager 100 rand, you get back 80, you re-wager 80. So it's kind of it's doubling, it's recycled. So it's a bit of a not a fictional number, but it's you have to understand what it's saying. It's the 75 billion, which is the big number, because that's leaving. That's going into the pockets of the people that are building the tools that do the gambling.
And that's a massive games. Wealth drain from households, isn't it?
It is. I mean, when you look at expenditure, I mean, Stats South Africa says that 55% of households spend on recreation, sport, and culture is going towards gambling. That's 1.6 of total household expenditure. So, yeah, it's across the board, and I'm sure you've seen it driving through small towns in South Africa. There's always a gaming store, and it's hard to ignore when you see it online all the time. You know, people gambling.
Andrew Fulton, of concern is the point that you make about overtaking school fees and even insurance. It says a lot about changing household priorities and the desperation that has crept into South African lives given the high cost of living and for people just looking for any way to make ends meet, even if it is gambling.
Yeah. I mean, what the interesting thing that we saw about a year ago, which surprised us, is, you know, we have a data portal that gives access to all of these secondary data sets. And a lot of them were coming up when it said, you know, how do you make your income? Sometimes an alternative revenue, but often in just your regular income, it was saying one of my sources of income is gambling. And I mean, if you know gambling, you know the house always wins. And it seems like a bit of a strange thing. But as I said, you know, that there are winners out there. You know, if people do feel that it gives a hope of being able to make ends meet in an economy that's had high inflation, where salaries have been flat, and that's, you know, now effectively a side hustle to some.
Yeah,
as misguided as that.
Never underestimate, I guess, the power of hope in an equation like that. What I also find quite interesting is there is a surge across both low income and high income households. Two ends of a spectrum that rarely move together. Why in this case do you think there's been some kind of coalescing?
Yeah, it's an interesting thought. I mean, so what we've noticed is not only is it wealthy and poor households, but obviously the correlation with that is educated and poorly educated individuals. The one big outlier is it is very male. It's a male dominated activity. But what I think, I mean, I think people that are good with numbers, people who are into data science, you know, they're also attracted to gambling and they're making good salaries and they can do it. And one thing we've noticed overseas is this convergence of, say, like a company like Robinhood is a convergence of share trading, Bitcoin trading, and gambling all on one platform. And essentially they are all at the end of the day, you know, dealing with risk and essentially gambling. So that I think is the appeal to the upper income as well.
And the changing nature of gambling is also interesting. You know, in decades past, it might have been a visit to the casino or even to the horse racing track, but now online platforms take 70% of revenue, if I've read the figure correctly. It says to me that regulation is failing maybe to keep pace with the speed of digital gambling.
Yeah, and I mean, unfortunately, that's the case with everything, whether it's the environment, whether it's data privacy, whether it's anything. You know, there's always business is going to move faster than government or legislation or governance. There was a National Gambling Amendment Bill in 2008 that didn't get passed. There's a current one that the DA has put on the table, which is the National Gambling Amendment Act. So, you know, there is an attempt to get something out there. The previous legislation really dealt more with illegal gambling and licensing, but now they're putting forward legislation to say, you know, can we protect vulnerable groups? Can we regulate online gambling? I mean, essentially, you know, playing slot-style games is illegal online. But, you know, just register on any of the platforms and you'll see games that, as far as I can tell, they look like slots. So you know, it is, there is certainly a lag from what's being done and what needs to be done in terms of governance.
To the best of your knowledge, is there a direct correlation between gambling advertising and something in the region of 2.5 billion rand is spent on that and the way in which it fuels addiction? Because if there is a direct correlation, maybe there should be some kind of advertising restriction. But I always get very nervous about over-regulating advertising.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, but you heard Sean Summers, CEO of Pick and Pay, saying that there should be a total ban on gambling ads. I mean, if you believe in marketing, you believe advertising works. And what we do know about gambling as well as smoking and drinking is it's an addictive behavior. So you know, there's obviously a strong correlation there. It's just, you know, the argument around, are these mature adults making decisions on their own and having an entertaining evening of gambling on online, or is it a societal problem that's really causing a lot of impact and negative impact of families in South Africa?
But where do you draw the line between those two interpretations? And that's the problem, isn't it? At some point, surely the market just self-corrects.
It should. And you know, from what I can see on the ground is a lot of the companies are kind of making hay while the sun shines because they realize that legislation has to come in at some stage or more impactful, more broad-reaching legislation has to come in at a future stage.
Just a final one then. If current trends continue and there's every likelihood that it will not only continue but probably amplify and accelerate, there is a long-term risk, isn't there, to households, to productivity and the economy. Difficult, though, to actually quantify that.
It's difficult, but if you look at the trends, I mean, this 1.5 trillion spend, that's up 36% from the previous year. You know, I defy you to find me another industry that's grown 36% in a year. And if it continues, obviously, it's just going to take more money out of the economy that would go to more productive endeavors or just groceries or clothing. You know, I think most industries are quite shocked at how much money it's taking away from their bottom line because it is so exciting and entertaining and, as we mentioned, possibly addictive.
Always a data-rich interview. Andrew Fulton, director at 8020. Thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, cabin crew at FlySaf Air, as I understand it, embarking on more industrial action after wage talks have deadlocked, the airline issuing an employer-initiated lockout from last night, but insisting that flights are continuing as scheduled. Management says its latest offer includes a 5.7% increase plus a 7.5% annual bonus. It's now seeking CCMA Section 150 mediation to fast-track a deal. FlySaf Air adds that November runs on reduced pre-festive maintenance and schedule anyway, with additional crew onboarded. That is helping, it says, keep operations stable. But I guess the question is, for how long? Joining us now from the airline, Kirby Gordon, a very warm welcome. What's the position as we speak today? Are you fully operational?
We are fully operational. Thanks, Jeremy. Yes, absolutely. All flights are departing as per schedule, and they're fully crewed and covered proportionately. So we are looking good.
Why a lockout now? What has changed at the negotiating table?
I think the lockout is an important mechanism that exists within the bigger kind of democratic framework to ensure that there's enough pressure on actually getting a solution put in place. So at this stage, a dispute was obviously declared some time ago within processes at the CCMA. 30 days passed since then, which brings us into the realm of protected industrial action in one direction or another with a sufficient notice, obviously. And it was important to us that we initiate this lockout in order to be able to put pressure on the situation and ensure that we get the maximum focus on ensuring that we get this across the line as soon as possible. And then, of course, also critically to preserve the airlift in the country around the G20 and, of course, ahead of the festive season.
How are you going to get this across the line then?
So it seems the good news is that it seems that things are going very well. As we speak right now, the parties are engaged in ongoing discussions. Last night there, we had some very constructive discussions. They didn't quite manage to get a signature onto the settlement agreement, but they are at the point where they are actually discussing the settlement agreement. So it seems that common ground is not far away.
Is your schedule really protected, though, if the situation either escalates or continues?
Not indefinitely. At this stage it is, and certainly over the next couple of weeks, which it would be, history-making if the strike were to extend far beyond that. But it certainly is for the time being, given that we've got this seasonally reduced flying ahead of the December period where there's some aircraft getting maintenance so that we can work them extra hard over that period, and the fact that we've got some additional crew on the books at the moment in order to be able to facilitate that flying as well. It is actually quite a fortuitous period for us to go through this particular particular growing pain and still be able to protect the schedule accordingly.
But relying on non-striking staff also risks morale within the airline and maybe even long-term stability. This is a risk, isn't it?
It's always a risk. I mean, the reality is, you know, everyone would always seek to avoid industrial action. It's always a course of last resort. Unfortunately, with an offer that is between 16 and 19% increase on the table, I mean, that is huge in the current economy. And we as a company do have to draw a line somewhere along the way to ensure our own sustainability in the long term. It's never a great situation. It certainly warrants a lot of work after the fact to try and repair that morale and to repair those relationships. But it is unfortunately the only course of action at this point.
It's the second round of industrial action, as far as I understand it. It also raises questions about the relationship between staff and the carrier, doesn't it?
It does. And that's, I think, a very, very legitimate question. We did have a pilot strike earlier in the year, and this is a cabin crew strike. What I can tell you, Jeremy, is that the relationship is actually very strong. SAFAir is a great employer. The teams are fantastically looked after, and generally the spirit in the environment is very good. I mean, I don't think that we would have engendered the success that we have thus far without teams that were really pulling apart. I mean, this airline has been built on the teams that work to it. But unfortunately, what we've got is a number of trade unions who are in an environment where they get to exercise a fair amount of power. Given the size that we have in the market, 67% of the domestic seat capacity, you know, if we were at 10% of the domestic seat capacity, they would be holding a company to ransom. But the reality is when they take on an airline of our scale and our scope, it's not just the company that they're holding to ransom, it's the flying public, it's the country, it's the economy. So there's quite a lot of power in their hands at this point. And of course, if you're at the negotiating table and you're trying to get a deal over the line and you're trying to get the very best deal, you're not going to take a knife to a gunfight.
Critics say that the lockout is maybe heavy-handed and it does risk your culture, or places risk to your culture. How do you justify a lockout?
I think that is a legitimate criticism, and it is certainly something to be seen. I think at this point, the reality is that the offer is just so incredibly high that it warrants the fact that we need to be quite stern about drawing a line in the sand to ensure that we get this over the line. And equally, we have a very significant responsibility to the public and to the economy to ensure that we maintain our air connectivity, and leaving the opportunity to call the industrial action into the hands of the union, who certainly would be able to do so before an important G20 event or around the 16th of December in order to create maximum damage and apply maximum pressure to the company, doesn't feel like a responsible course of action for us.
It seems to me, and again, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but a lunch break issue also seems central to the dispute. It would seem to me that this is a basic workplace right. What's the issue here and why hasn't it been resolved?
It's actually a new issue that's come to the fore. Jeremy, to be honest, there was a discussion right in the beginning of some of the substantive negotiations around a number of the basic conditions of employment that the union certainly had a different interpretation as to how we employ those in our general policies. Of course, we use the same procedures that have been used by all airlines and that we've been using for the last 10 years, so we differ on that view. But the agreement between ourselves and them was to say, well, let's take this to the Department of Labor and have an interpretation done, and you know, we'll both abide by whatever that is. So that was actually an agreement that's been on the table all along. The reality is that according to the Minister of Labour, you know, cabin attendants are highly paid employees, so a lot of those provisions below the threshold in the basic conditions don't necessarily apply to them. So we're quite confident that we're on the right side of everything and that the Department of Labour will find that there. So it really just needs to be agreed and understood that this is part of that remit.
Just a line to this, and you did reference the G20. How ready are you for the G20 rush on travel? And is flying going to be more expensive come the end of this month?
We certainly are ready. If we can get over this hurdle, which we anticipate doing, by then we should have plenty of airlift and capacity to be able to do it. Obviously, we also have to prepare ourselves for the big December rush, which is possibly the biggest part of the year, and I think still will remain so, even past this point. The reality on pricing, yes, Jeremy, I mean, it's always about supply and demand. So if there is a period where there's a great degree of demand and we throw in as much supply as we can at it, but there's still more demand than the supply is available, we will see an increase in pricing. That's a natural consequence of the sort of ebbs and flows of the market that we trade on. But I don't anticipate that it'll be anything near the sorts of highs that we would see during peak holiday periods.
Kobe Gordon from FlySafair, thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Education technology takes center stage at the end of the month as South African Ed Tech Week returns to Cape Town, now in its fourth edition. The gathering, as I understand it, brings together innovators, funders, policymakers, teachers and academics, all with a clear focus on how to make technology work in under-resourced schools and classrooms. It's a big issue. And this is a practical, evidence-driven summit, I understand, aimed at solving real implementation challenges and not just discussing future theory. Joining me now is Kelly Fisher from Engini, the organization convening the event alongside the MasterCard Foundation. Kelly, what does EdTech readiness mean then in an under-resourced context and in practice? Where's the problem and how do we measure it?
So for EdTech readiness, what it means is that if, let's say, tomorrow we all woke up and everyone, all classrooms around South Africa had access to, let's say, tablets or computers, they still wouldn't be able to use either the tablets or computers or the software installed on that because they are just not EdTech ready. We are finding that there are these like second order barriers such as teacher training, learner, they have like tech weariness, and there are other infrastructure problems as well that will still limit the ability to be EdTech ready. And so we really wanted to discuss and unpack this and understand, okay, what is making teachers not EdTech ready? What are making schools not EdTech ready? And also, why are learners not as able to adopt EdTech themselves?
And we've got to get to grips with this sooner rather than later, because globally, I imagine we are falling further and further behind the curve, and that has an impact on our competitiveness.
Absolutely. We are seeing that on a global level, they're ready to implement things like VR and AR and all these wonderful gizmo that we're coming up with, but in South Africa and also on the continent as a whole, we are falling behind because we have things like infrastructure things, and we're not focusing on the rural learners or the low-income communities as much as we'd like to because of these barriers. And so yes, we are falling more and more behind, and we're finding also that there's a widening of the gap between the schools that are able to implement these high-end technologies and the lower-income schools, because these more well-resourced schools and more well-funded schools are able to really fly ahead in terms of using this technology, but the ones who are sitting in the rural classroom aren't able to keep up because they're still stuck in an overcrowded classroom. They hardly have access to regular textbooks, never mind EdTech.
So the biggest implementation barrier, I would imagine, is probably a combination of lack of devices, poor connectivity. You've already mentioned teacher support, policy alignment, but maybe overarching all of that is money.
Yes, absolutely. Like, one, we need money to fund EdTech, and we need money for infrastructure, and we're seeing that those who are funding EdTech are maybe expecting a faster turnaround on the investment, where you really have to be a lot more patient when it comes to EdTech because it's behavior change that you're actually investing in. And so we really need money, and we need some patient money, should we say that.
I understand that it does take time, but we're running out of it, aren't we?
We are indeed running out of it. We're seeing that our learning gaps are expanding. There was a report recently that actually showed that on a foundational level, the South African learner is just falling very far behind. And yeah, we are actually playing catch up now.
So what are the most realistic funding models then for EdTech in low-income schools? How do you get that right, and who pays for it?
We're seeing some interesting funding models. And so for those in low-income schools from the cohort that we support or the edtech companies that we support, we're seeing a lot of private investment that's actually coming from the tech industry, the telecoms industry, the bigger businesses like McDowell Foundations and those things. But we're also seeing that we need philanthropic investment. We need some CSR investment. So those are the kind of investments that we're seeing in EdTech or that we're needing in the schools and EdTech. We are trying to understand that there's not as much VC funding available for EdTech companies, and so we're moving towards more foundations, philanthropic,
right,
private funding. Yeah.
Kelly, just a final question from me. I'm very cynical about conferences like this. What kind of outcome or commitment do you want from government and industry after this gathering, not just conversations? Because you've already told me we're running out of time.
We want the commitments on things like partnerships. We want MOUs. We don't necessarily want them to say like, okay, we will give you money, because we know that we're not going to get that from government. They themselves have told us they don't have a lot of money to invest in EdTech because they're just trying to get children to school and just trying to feed children. Mm. And so we want things like MOUs where we can work together, where they can give us access to schools to test the efficacy of EdTech in these lower income schools especially. And so those are the kind of commitments we're looking for. And it's the same with the corporates. And so as an example, we're entering into an MOU with a foundation for a big retailer, I won't mention the name right now, where they are giving us access to the schools that they support in their local communities, where we can actually test if EdTech works, and if it doesn't work, like, why is it not working, and also the actual impact on learning outcomes.
Kelly Fisher, thank you very much indeed. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.